Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh, and I'm joined as always by Frank Cogliano. How are you doing, Frank?
Hi, David. I'm doing fine. Thank you very much.
All right, let's dive right in. A week ago today, President Trump signed a bill to avoid a government shutdown, but at the same time declared a national emergency to divert funds that have been allocated to other projects to fund his border wall. And so I thought today we'd talk about the history of national emergencies to sort of put Trump's declaration into some context. Trump is citing a 1976 law, the National Emergencies Act, which he claims gives him 100% authority. To use his words, to do this kind of national emergency declaration, but we want to sort of dive a little bit before that. So, Frank, what do you think is the precedence that we should look to make sense of what is a national emergency, and does Trump's action sort of fall within our sort of usual historical framework for these things?
Well, David, the first thing I should say is, greetings to you and all of our listeners, because I am actually speaking from America, the United States, during this time of national emergency. And I'm
Yeah,
inspired.
is this just
I mean,
situation normal there? Are there like armed militia people marching around or whatever it is you'd expect during a national emergency?
well, I'll tell you that my staff, the staff and colleagues and friends here at the International Center for Jefferson Studies are having their Friday morning coffee right now, and they've had two big boxes of Krispy Kreme donuts. So we're all coping in our own ways, David, but we struggle with this emergency as best we can. And so people are, it's really the Blitz spirit, as people are really kind of rallying together to confront this emergency. In terms of historical precedents, there are precedents at other times in American history that we'll probably get to. And you and I were chatting about some of these before we came on the air. Things like the Whiskey Rebellion, from which we get our name, the Nullification Crisis, the Civil War, and so on. We'll get to those. I think there's a precedent, though, that goes even further back in history that we need to consider.
All right, lay it on me.
All right. And it concerns, we're going to go back into British and, in fact, English history for this one, which is the dispute over ship money involving King Charles I. Undoubtedly, this came to mind for you, as it
This
did
that's
for
the
me.
first thing I thought of when Trump was declared. I'm sure it's the first thing Trump was thinking of too. Great,
No, he's
so
got a deep understanding. Charles I, he's the best Charles, because he's the first. Well, and the reason I'm invoking this is actually, I think there's an important constitutional principle here, which is President Trump, in declaring the emergency. So the background a week ago is that he signed the revenue bill, and he did so grudgingly. It was basically a climb down on his part. And in order to kind of satisfy his base, whom he's promised that he'll provide this wall for, he declared a national emergency under the 1976 Act, and in so doing, he's seeking to mobilize the funding to build the wall without recourse to Congress. And the reason that led me to think of King Charles I is because in the 1630s, King Charles tried to, well, in fact, he did raise revenue by reverting to something called ship money. And there was a legal case, there was a ship money dispute that ensued. And I think there's an important precedent for this, or that historical example gives a precedent that might be germane to, we know that 16 states are challenging Trump's emergency decree in the courts because he's circumventing Congress. And I think the ship money case is a possible precedent. So let me explain. Basically, ship money was a feudal tax that had kind of remained on the books in England, whereby during times of war, taxpayers in coastal cities could be compelled, without resort to parliament and without parliamentary approval, they could be compelled by the crown to pay what was called ship money for the defense, to build ships in time of war, for the defense of England. And this law and this tradition had kind of fallen into disuse by the time Charles I became king in the 1620s. Charles I revived it first in 1628 and then in 1634 and 1636. And the reason Charles I did this was because he couldn't get along with Parliament. In fact, he prorogued Parliament for the better part of a decade. So he tried to govern without resort to Parliament. And Charles sought to extend the ship money law to the entire Kingdom of England. That is, it wouldn't just be coastal cities. It would be all taxpayers in England would be subject to paying ship money dues. And crucially, he sought to do so during peacetime, not just during wartime. So, and this is where I do think that, you know, the case is germane for the what we're seeing in the United States at the moment. What Charles did was seek to invoke emergency powers, as it were, that were traditionally reserved for wartime and raising revenue for brief periods of time during wartime to peacetime in an effort to circumvent Parliament. So I think there are some real parallels here, which might be of interest to those, as I said, those states' attorneys general who are bringing this case against against the government, against President Trump's policy. The ship money case or ship money was challenged in court. Charles won by a I think it was the Court of the Exchequer, which actually decided this. Charles won by a 7-5 vote, but it established a precedent whereby the kind of backlash against the ship money case helped establish the precedent of parliamentary supremacy where it came to raising funds, which was, of course, built into the American constitutional system. That's why this is important. It was those lessons of the 17th century that imbued and inspired a lot of the debates over the federal constitution in the United States and why Congress was given the power of the purse, which was a power that Parliament had to fight for in the 17th century. And that 17th century, those 17th century British precedents were very important to the men who framed the U.S. Constitution in 1787. So I do think there is a direct relevance. As a postscript, I'll point out that Charles I was, of course, eventually overthrown.
Yeah, I was going to get to that.
Executed. So it didn't end well for Charles. I don't know whether President Trump has taken any note of that example. So I think that is relevant. I don't know whether – does that make sense?
No, I think it does. I mean, I think that – I mean, part of the ways in which this particular emergency with the wall is different maybe than some of the other ways in which emergencies have been declared both before and after this 1976 law is that it has to do with allocation of money rather than some other kind of measure. Most of the national emergencies that have been declared previously under this statute from 1976 have to do with embargoing certain kind of trade articles or dealing with sanctions on certain countries. There's a sanction, for instance, on blood diamonds.
That's right. Most of the modern ones have been kind of negative, if they will. There are often sanctions on countries that the United States is deemed misbehaving in some way, thus creating the emergency.
So yeah, but not they're not the power of the purse is really one of the well defined powers, you know, in the Constitution. So let's thinking about the Constitution. Let's look there to see whether we can think about what the Constitution says, if anything, about emergency powers and what kinds of powers the presidency has in times of emergency. Is there anything that jumps out to you, Frank, in terms of ways in which emergencies, however one defines that, changes the powers of the executive?
I mean, the Constitution, of course, seeks to limit the power of the federal government in a lot of ways. And, I mean, Article 2 lays out the president's powers, and I'm trying to think of what I mean. Nothing jumps to mind. What do you have in mind in asking?
Well, there's a couple of little bits and pieces that sort of jump out to me. One is there's a bit in Article 1, Section 9, which is actually
everybody follow along.
Everyone get out their Constitution, follow along. Article 1, Section 9, which if you're remembering your sort of structure of Article 1. Article 1, Section 8 is all the powers of Congress. Article 1, Section 9 is all the limitations of the power of Congress. And one of the things Article 1, Section 9 says is there's a part about the writ of habeas corpus, which basically is about this enshrining this common law right that everyone has, that the government's not going to lock you up without a reason. And it says that it shall not be suspended unless when in cases of rebellion or invasion, the public safety may require it. You know, and so I think, you know, one of the things I think is embedded in that is this idea is that we have this rule that there's going to be a right of habeas corpus for people in the United States or citizens of the United States, however you want to think about that in this particular
habeas case. Corpus means produce the body in Latin. So yes. You can't just throw people in jail without recourse. Without the body, the person has to be charged and has to appear in court.
Exactly. So, you know, but this right is embedded in the Constitution. It's actually one of the very few individual rights that is embedded in the Constitution. But it also has this clause in there that says, unless there's something weird happening, it doesn't say weird, but it says, you know, unless there's a case of a rebellion or insurrection, then the right of habeas corpus can be suspended and the government can lock people up without charging them. Right. And so there's this sort of, in my reading, there's like an implicit recognition when they're writing the Constitution that, you know, there are situation normal rules, and then there are sort of extraordinary times in which the rules may have to be suspended. I mean, the other place that jumps out to me, there's this part in Article 2 where they're talking about the powers of the president. And they're talking, this is again, Section 3, if you're reading along at home. He may, on extraordinary occasions, convene both houses or either of them, and in cases of disagreement between them with respect to the time of adjournment, etc. So he can call Congress into session on extraordinary occasions, you know, and so this is an idea that there is a usual cycle of schedule of how government's supposed to work. But that things can get weird sometimes, and there's, you know, powers about calling out the militia and all these other kinds of things that suggest that there is some sort of alternative sets of rules, especially when there's a, you know, in wartime. How extensive those are when those come into play, I think, is up in the air. I think that's one of the places where the Constitution is ambiguous, and one of the sort of fights over the next 200 years is really, you know, when those things happen. But I think that's embedded within sort of the document in places.
I agree, but it's interesting because it's really embedded is the right word. And the two examples you cite are very good. With respect to the first one, two things are interesting to me. One is that it's in the clause that stipulates the power and authority of Congress. Mm. So it assumes or implies certainly that it's Congress that's important. And Congress, of course, is the more is meant to be the more popular small d democratic branch of the government. And so I think there's a recognition there that this is unusual, but that it will, at least the framers of the Constitution were anticipating that it would be to Congress to decide when those circumstances arose rather than to the president. Although there's a contradiction as well, and that's my kind of second point arising from that, because when it comes to the suspension of habeas corpus, that's an authority that has been exercised, and we'll probably talk about this in a moment, by the president, not by Congress. So I think there's an inherent kind of tension there. The other thing I'd observe is, you know, the Constitution was framed in the aftermath of a lengthy war, the American War of Independence, and that war taught men who would frame the Constitution several lessons. One of which I think that we forget is that the Constitution is not meant to be a suicide pact, and by that I mean, one of the legacies and the most important legacy of the American Revolution is that the United States should be a republic governed by laws. So the rule of law is meant to be sacrosanct, and the Constitution is the the ultimate rule of law. I mean, it's the rules. If this were a board game, those are the fundamental rules everybody's got to play by. And it's a republic that's supposed to adhere to the rule of law. However, recognition, and this was proved repeatedly during the War of Independence, that sometimes in particular circumstances and particular emergencies, you can't be too punctilious about these things. So, you know, Jefferson, for example, it doesn't always come back to Jefferson, but that's an example I've written about. You know, when Jefferson was governor of Virginia, he was hamstrung because Virginia's constitution created a very weak executive, and the British invaded the state while he was governor of Virginia. And if he had followed the exact letter of the law as stipulated in the Virginia Constitution, he couldn't have done anything in anticipation, in preparation, or in response to the British invasion, because the governor's council was never quorate because they were scattered all over the state fleeing the British. And so sometimes, under exceptional circumstances, the framers of the Constitution recognized in emergencies, It's necessary to take action that might be not illegal, but extra legal. On the other hand, there are two crucial qualifiers to this. One is that action should be limited in duration. And secondly, if at all possible, there should be kind of ex post facto approval by Congress for what's been done. So you can't have a permanent state of emergency under those circumstances. At least that was what the framers of the Constitution understood, I think. And I think that's why those kind of emergency powers, as you describe them, are embedded rather than explicit. It wasn't the intention of the framers. It wasn't the intention of the framers to have permanent states of emergency. So on one hand, there's a recognition that sometimes you have to kind of, if not bend the rules, stretch them a little bit in response to a crisis. But that activity should be of limited duration and should be only in response to moments of crisis, to real emergencies.
Yeah, I think that's right. But deciding, you know, who gets to decide what's a real emergency, I think is part of what the struggle has been over the past 200 years.
Because we've had multiple
cases where you know, is it the president who decides who the emergency is? Is it Congress? Is it the courts? Is it a state, perchance, that makes these decisions?
Yeah, I mean, let's for the sake of argument take President Trump at his word here. And so if he believes sincerely that there is a crisis on the southern border and that drugs and there's trafficking of people and there's trafficking of drugs and there's trafficking of terrorists and so on, that the southern border represents a security threat to the United States, and Congress has refused to appropriate the money to build a wall to defend that border, is that then a national emergency? His position is yes, it's a national emergency, and so I'm doing what is necessary because Congress won't do it. Does that fit the kind of constitutional definition of how to deal with an emergency?
You know, the constitutional definition is so vague, I think you can read it either way. Whether it fits the requirement of the National Emergencies Act from 1976, I think, is a slightly different question. I think there it seems to. Although
the Constitution is more germane, because to some extent, as I said a moment ago, those are first principles, right? I mean, so
yes.
I don't think it does, because it's not of limited duration and it's not in response to a particular, you know, this wall, ever built, is only going to be built over a long period of time, which doesn't seem to fit the kind of, as I said, you have to kind of meet an immediate crisis with exceptional action. Whether it fits the law, the later law, because I think the authority of the presidency has evolved considerably since 1787. I'm not sure the constitutional first principles necessarily apply, but I think it's interesting to think about this emergency trying to apply those principles. I don't think it meets the constitutional principles, whether it meets the principles or the requirements laid down by the 1976 Act, I think is more debatable. What about some of the subsequent emergencies, you know, prior to 1976, the kind of prehistory of this?
Yeah. So I think, you know, most of these have to do either with some kind of rebellion or actual war. So we've got the Whiskey Rebellion our favorite rebellion. Whether I don't think Washington actually used the word national emergency, but he's clearly behaving as if this is not situation normal, using the militia to suppress a rebellion. We can think of the nullification crisis from 1833, in which Jackson threatens to use the national, to use the military to collect taxes in South Carolina, which had threatened to nullify, to exert what they thought was their sovereign authority to nullify a national statute. There's some really interesting ones from the Civil War, in which the president is using a national emergency to justify actions that would probably not be under his authority in not when it wasn't wartime. Probably the most famous, of course, is the Emancipation Proclamation, which he draws on his authority as commander-in-chief. But also one of the ones that is somewhat less known but is probably just as relevant is Lincoln's suspension of habeas corpus in Maryland. So for those of you who remember, this Maryland was a slave-holding state, but one that did not leave the Union but had lots of Southern sympathizers in it. And in April of 1861, Lincoln suspended the writ of habeas corpus in the area between Washington, D.C. and Philadelphia, basically as a measure to give military authorities some power to suppress a rebellion if a rebellion did take place, and there were already riots and demonstrations taking place in the streets in Boston, or sorry, in Baltimore and other places.
And to prevent Maryland from seceding from the Union.
Ultimately, yes. And one of the guys who gets arrested in this, a person who was in favor of secession, a guy named John Merryman, was arrested and held in Fort McHenry in Baltimore. He wasn't charged with anything at the way that the writ of habeas corpus would require. The people holding him said, look, the president has suspended the writ of habeas corpus. And he sues, and the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Roger Taney, issued a ruling, said basically the president didn't have the power to suspend habeas corpus, that even in wartime, that was an excessive use of his power. Article 1, Section 9 that mentions habeas corpus is the part that talks about Congress, and it talks about when habeas corpus is suspended, but it doesn't say who has the power to suspend it. And so there was this sort of fight between the president and the courts over who exactly had that power. Eventually, Congress passed a law that gave the president the right, in that case, to suspend habeas corpus. But that, I think, is a precedent where the president tried to use an emergency and got shot down by the courts. Another more recent case, I think, as a precedent, is the Youngstown Steel case from 1952. This is during the Korean War. The background to this there was a steel strike during the Korean War. President Truman was very concerned about the access to steel as part of the war effort. They tried to mediate between the Union and the industry, which didn't go anywhere. And he basically tried to force the government to take over. He tried to institute a government takeover of the plants to run them for the benefit of military production. And the court shot him down and said this was an excessive use of government authority, that the president had powers, unenumerated powers in the Constitution, in wartime, but seizing and running a steel plant wasn't one of them. And so it's another place where the courts are sort of limiting this sort of broader notion of executive power to act in a case of an emergency. I think that's a case that's probably going to be cited pretty heavily because it's a relatively recent case.
I think the ship money case is going to be pretty.
Oh, I think obviously. I mean, that goes without saying, Frank. That the ship money case will be top line, and then the Youngstown Steel. When we get though to this, the actual piece of legislation that President Trump is citing, the National Emergencies Act, I think it's worth sort of putting that piece of legislation into context. What's going on so this gets passed in 1976, what's going on that makes Congress decide that's the right time to define what a national emergency is and what the president can and can't do?
Well, I think there's a lot going on. I mean, it's the bicentennial of the revolution, 1976.
Oh, of course. That's the reason.
But that might not have been foremost in the thinking of Congress when it came to the Emergencies Act. I think, look, we're in the immediate aftermath of Watergate, but the Cold War is still going on. And so in the immediate aftermath of Watergate, there's a great deal of concern in Congress about trying to enumerate and, frankly, limit the powers of the presidency. Since 1945, in what Arthur Schlesinger called the imperial presidency, the development of the imperial presidency, presidents had acquired massive power during the Cold War, down to and indeed well after Richard Nixon. But Watergate was a particular kind of turning point in that story because with the Watergate scandal and the Nixon presidency and the resignation of President Nixon, there was a sense that Nixon as president had kind of abused and overstepped the powers of the presidency. And immediately after that, Congress began to look at ways to limit the president's powers by enumerating those powers. And I think there are two pieces of legislation that are important. One is the Emergencies Act of 1976, we're talking about, the National Emergencies Act of 1976. The other is the War Powers Act, which I think is the same year. And both
War Powers Act, I think, is 73.
Sorry, apologies. But the War Powers Act limits the authority of the president, or it allows the president to use military force overseas, but limits the duration of that those actions and says that the president has to go to Congress for approval. So it's what we see is that tension that goes right back to the clause in Article 1 you cited earlier in our chat, David, which is, there's a tension between the president's authority and the authority of Congress. And the War Powers Act was a manifestation of this, as is the National Emergencies Act. It allows the president to declare national emergencies, but it also stipulates that Congress can override those emergencies if it sees fit. And indeed, we may well see that unfold, I think, in response to Trump's declaration of a national emergency. I suspect the House of Representatives under Nancy Pelosi is going to vote on this and probably vote against it and compel, therefore, a response from the Republican-dominated Senate. The point being, the National Emergencies Act of 1976 not only gives the president authority to issue a declaration of emergency, but it also has built into it some congressional oversight for that and some congressional limitations. So on one hand, it's a codification of presidential power, but it's also a limitation of presidential power. And I think you asked what the context was. I think that's a direct response to the excesses of the Nixon presidency and the Watergate crisis. Would you agree with that, Dan?
No, I think that's exactly right. I think Congress is recognizing that, you know, in a 20th century, three quarters of the way through the 20th century context, the president needs to have the power to act quickly, whether in response to, you know, Soviet aggression or in terms of other kinds of emergencies. And that may require the president to do things that Congress can't anticipate beforehand. On the other hand, I think this is a piece of legislation, and I think sometimes the way the reporting on this has been recently, I think, has been mischaracterizing it, because I think this this link with the War Powers Act, I think is right. It's about both giving the president a great deal of leeway, but then also giving Congress the ability to hold the president accountable for those times when he or she chooses to use these kinds of extraordinary powers. You know, one of the other things that one of the provisions of the National Emergency Act, and one of the things they cite when they pass it, is that emergencies need to come to an end, and that you need to sort of justify continuing emergencies if there are continuing emergencies. One of the things they point out is that President Nixon in 1970 had declared a national emergency because there was a postal strike going on to deal with the postal strike. And the postal strike ended, but Nixon never said the emergency was over, right? And so there are provisions in it for requiring the president to either reaffirm that emergencies are continuing and therefore the measures embedded within them are continuing, or to have those get emergency measures being stripped away. So, I mean, it has this provision, it has sort of this extraordinary provision in it that allows Congress to challenge a presidential executive determination of there's a national emergency, which I think is you're right, that's probably what's going to happen, and it does sort of force congressmen to go on the record about their views on the national emergency. One of the things that's going to happen here, unlike most things, is if the House passes a measure calling the president to account for this national emergency, the Senate will also then have to act on it. So Mitch McConnell can't sit on his hands the way he does with most things.
That's right. He is compelled to act on it. He cannot ignore it.
And he has to act. There's a time frame embedded within it. I don't remember exactly what it is, but it's a pretty short time frame. What would then happen, I think, is that Trump would still be able to veto that, because effectively what that is another piece of legislation. So whether they can actually stop the wall through that mechanism is unclear, but probably not, given that they don't have a veto-proof majority in both houses. What other alternatives? Well, let's look at how this law has been applied in the 40 years since its passage.
It's mainly been applied. I'm sorry, David. It's mainly been applied to, as I think we alluded to earlier, in terms of in the foreign policy realm, in response to sanctioning countries that are seen to be behaving in ways that are inimical to the interests of the United States, and thus the emergency is created. In some cases, there might be nations that are acting in a way that's creating a humanitarian emergency, in response to natural disasters. But in most cases, so there are the ongoing sanctions against Iran, for example, that the United States has imposed go back to a national emergency declaration.
I think have actually been the first one that uses this new uses this piece of legislation.
That's right. And things like Sierra Leone over blood diamonds, and there are a number of these that have been applied, some of which are still in force, some of which are not. And they've been applied by presidents of both parties. But mainly these declarations have been used in the international realm. One could argue, again, in defense of President Trump, that this is also an international emergency because it's about the border between the United States and Mexico. I'm less persuaded by that, but that would be an argument that could be made.
Now, obviously, one of the things that is different, and I mentioned this earlier, is that most of these are not about – I'm just looking at all of them right now. I can't think of any of these that actually involve reallocation of funds that have been allocated by Congress to certain projects, which makes this, I think, a very different kind of executive action than most of these others. One of them, for instance, there's one having to do with swine flu, but it's more about sort of changing policies.
Yes, one, so would, think... one were to, sorry, if one were to make the case against President Trump, I mean, I kind of made the case, in, you know, stated his case a few minutes ago. The counter argument is, look, you couldn't get your money out of the budgeting process, which is stipulated by the Constitution. And so you're trying to circumvent that and go around it to get money for something you want. Well, and one could argue that that action is not what the National Emergencies Act was intended for, and is arguably illegal and unconstitutional. And the courts may well decide this.
And I think he almost admits this. He admitted this a week ago in this press conference, where he said, basically, I could have done this without declaring a national emergency, but it would have been slower, and I'd prefer to do it this way because it's faster.
Right. If you could do it the other way, then clearly it's not an emergency.
Emergency, right. Now, I mean, if you actually sort of apply that rubric to it with a strictly to all the previous national emergencies, I'm not quite sure all of them hold up quite as well. I mean, the for instance, the one with banning blood diamonds, which was put in place in
2000. Oh no, it's later.
Well, that was put in place by Clinton in January of 2001, 2 days before he left office.
Right.
And he mentions in that one that blood diamonds have been a problem for 10 years. Clearly, he's using that as a sort of last minute because he was about to demit office. So you know, you could question some of these along the similar kinds of lines, suggesting that Congress has, you know, given the president a lot of leeway. You know, thinking about these mechanisms that Congress has to challenge a declaration of a national emergency, this is Congress hasn't used that power really at all since 1976. That there has been a shift both in this piece of legislation and more broadly from the legislative branch to the executive branch in terms of both creating policy and in giving the president a great deal of discretion about how the president uses resources and funds, really ever since, I guess, probably the Great Depression.
How do you think this is going to go, David? I mean, it seems to me there are two tracks of resistance or response to this politically. One is legal, and that is we've got 16 states' attorneys general getting ready to sue the government in response to this. And so there'll be a legal process that's undertaken. And as we were alluding to a moment ago, there's likely to be, I think there will be a vote of some kind in Congress. I suspect that it'll pass the House of Representatives, which has a Democratic majority, and will fail in the Senate. So I don't even think it'll get to the point where President Trump will have to veto it. But I think that will force people to take a stand on this. And I think the Democrats could be quite canny by forcing Republicans, especially vulnerable Republican senators coming up with 2020 in mind, to take a stand on this and vote. But what do you think? How do you think the opposition will play out?
All right. So I think with regards to the court cases, I think that a court somewhere will issue a stay to stop the wall from being built. But when they actually get to a hearing on the substance of the suits, I think the states filing suit are going to have a very hard time looking at this piece of legislation saying that Trump doesn't have this power. Now they're going to be able to use his own words against him, where he says this isn't actually, you know, where he says I could have done it in a different way, which suggests it's not an actual emergency. But there's a decent chance, especially if it gets up to the Supreme Court, that Trump's interpretation is going to not be, you know, struck down by the courts, which tend to be fairly conservative in their sort of deference to executive power, at least especially in cases of emergencies. Although we can, you know, mention the earlier cases like, you know, Youngstown Steel, where that wasn't the case. I think your reading of what happens with Congress is probably right. They'll probably pass some legislation, or they'll probably pass the resolution that makes, or have a resolution that forces congressmen to make a stand on it. The question is how long all this takes to play out. Because, you know, we do have an election coming up in, 22 months? And, you know, if you tie things up in the courts for a long time, that election's going to get closer and closer, and that's going to complicate the actual physical building of this wall. What do you think, Frank?
Well, I you know, kind of, I think your analysis of the legal side is perceptive and probably correct. I think politically it's interesting. So I think, as I suggested a moment ago, it might be a good move of Democrats to force Republicans to come out and vote on this one way or the other, because I think particularly Republicans in districts that, you know, voted for Hillary Clinton, for example, will find themselves vulnerable on that. And perhaps so-called moderate Republicans, especially in the Senate, if they're forced to come out one way or the other, will find themselves in a vulnerable position. Having said that, I think your last point is really germane. I'm not entirely sure how this plays in 2020. Because on one hand, allowing the Senate to vote, or forcing the Senate to vote on this, will allow some of the many Democratic senators who are running for president, Amy Klobuchar, Kamala Harris, Cory Booker, etc., to Bernie Sanders now, to kind of make a statement and make a stand against the wall, and yes, will be high profile. On the other hand, if this is stuck in the courts and there's been a vote, an unsuccessful vote in Congress, you could easily see how President Trump can tell his followers, look, I'm doing my best, but I'm being hamstrung by these Democrats who want open borders. And while I don't think that's an accurate description of the situation, I think it's an incredibly compelling and persuasive description of the situation that he makes it forcefully, and I think it does have some effect. And so if the wall isn't being built because, and there's this political furore going on around it, that could work to his advantage in 2020.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things, though, that the forcing Republicans in both the House and Senate to go on record about this, one of the ways in which that complicates things for them, this whole situation complicates things for them, is even if they're in favor of the wall, I think a lot of them are going to have a difficult time defending to their constituents this kind of executive power grab, if that's one way
to characterize it.
For a couple of reasons. One is they're worried about what happens if a Democrat takes control of the White House, in which case you can imagine a Democrat saying climate change is a national emergency, a global emergency, and therefore we're going to take steps. Gun violence is a national emergency, and so therefore I'm going to take steps. You know, healthcare is a national emergency, and so therefore we're going to... You know, there's all kinds of ways in which...
Yep.
There are real pressing political questions that could be described as a national emergency if you, you know, increase the scope of national emergency to be whatever it is you want it to be. And so if the extraordinary moments become ordinary moments, I think there's concern about that. The other sort of weakness that Republicans have, if they have to go on record, is a lot of this money that Trump is claiming to use to build the wall is coming from the military budget. And, you know, the way in which military funding is distributed throughout the country, you know, often it is distributed into people's, it's done rather creatively in order to distribute money into different congressmen's districts. And so for their doing things like funding, you know, one of the pots of money that he's borrowing, stealing, appropriating, use whatever term you think is appropriate. One of the pots of money is for military housing, of which there's already a significant deficit in many places. So you could see lots of traditional Republican voters being very upset about the fact that the military housing that they were promised in their district isn't materializing. And it's instead being used to fund a border wall in the middle of the desert. So there's, I think, there's multiple ways in which this could backfire on Republicans politically, which makes those particular votes, I think, very, very tricky.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. I mean, we're going to see this play out over months, I think, and the drama is not over with this wall.
No, I think this next month is, in particular, is going to be particularly interesting, both with the wall drama and with the Mueller report, which we're hearing rumors may come out or may be at least given to the Attorney General within the next week or two. So, you know, between that and Brexit, I think March is proving to be a interesting time to be alive.
We'll be with you throughout, listeners. Don't despair.
No, I think there's plenty of reason to despair, whether we're there or not, Frank. I think despair is probably the correct emotion to have in some of these cases. But there's whiskey, so, you know, all good things. Speaking of which, time for last drops. What you got?
Yeah, I want to call attention to an article that appeared in yesterday's New York Times about President Obama's non-presidential library. The story highlighted the fact that former President Obama, is building the Obama Presidential Center on the south side of Chicago. And this is a museum, but it won't really be a presidential library. By that, I mean that it will not have a research library attached to it, which I think is a really worrying and unfortunate development. Presidential libraries go back to 1939 when FDR created one at his Hyde Park home in New York. The National Archives runs presidential libraries. Congress retrospectively created one for Herbert Hoover. So we've had presidential libraries for all 13 presidents since Hoover. And they're centers for research. And among other things, they often, the problem arises because they also are museums in many cases, and they're institutions that former presidents now use to pursue their post-presidential agendas. And so to some extent, this is what former President Obama is doing, is the logical culmination of what we've seen over the past couple of decades with regard to presidential libraries. But it's a worrying development because presidential libraries are actually quite important to scholars and to the public, and they need to be research libraries run by the National Archives. And in this case, President Obama is going to have a four-building, 19-acre Working Center for Citizenship, it's called. It's going to be built on the south side of Chicago. It's going to include a 235-foot-high museum tower with a two-story event space, an athletic center, a recording studio, a winter garden, and a sledding hill. Those are all wonderful things, but I think it also needs to be a library. And I think the fact that President Obama is not having a library is or a formal library, I mean, his records will be held in the National Archives, I suppose, is worrying. There's always been a little bit of attention. I don't know how many of these presidential libraries you've been to, because the more recent ones that are also museums tend to kind of worship the subject or to present a quite positive view of the subject, whichever president they're associated with, and that's slightly problematic in a government institution. But this is a worrying development, I think, and it's a disappointing development from a president who I think has quite a good historical sense and appreciation for the importance of scholarship.
Well, so I'm going to push back on that, Greg. I saw the article, and I saw the outrage on Twitter about the fact that it's not going to be a archive in the traditional sense. But their explanation for why they're not building an archive in the traditional sense is they say they're going to try to digitize all the presidential records, which potentially is a much more democratic way of making those records accessible.
They're only going to digitize, though, the ones that are in the public that are already in the public sphere, as it were. I mean, because eventually, you know, what about the classified documents 50 years from now, 75 years from now, things like that?
I thought they were going to try to digitize those as they became available.
It wasn't clear from my reading of it. But anyway,
okay. But me, just in terms of thinking about one of the sort of potential problems with some of these presidential libraries is, you know, like all archival sources, if you have to travel there to do the work, that is inherently limiting the people who can access it to the people who have the resources to do that. Thinking about our students here in Edinburgh, I mean, you know, a lot of them want to do, honors dissertations on particular topics. And if they're, available online, that opens up a whole set of possibilities that that they wouldn't have if they had to travel to Chicago to look at the pieces of paper.
Sure, but there, it's not a zero-sum game. I mean, digitizing archives is incredibly important. The National Archives does that and will continue to do so. But research libraries are also important.
Oh, to be sure. They may rethink this. I think they're still sort of in the planning phases, and it sounds like
I hope they do.
All right. Speaking of digitization, I've got a last drop that's about a digital project called Freedom on the Move, and this is a project that's been in the works for several years. It's a project that is based out of Cornell, they actually have several different universities working on it. University of Kentucky, University of Ohio, University of New Orleans, University of Alabama, a few other places. And the project is about putting on fugitive slave ads online. And there have been earlier projects that have done bits and pieces of this, but this is the largest project to try to digitize fugitive slave ads. In fact, I'm looking right now at the title page of it. One of the ads they've got to show you as a sample is one put by a Mr. Thomas Jefferson, who was putting an ad for a runaway slave. But part of the interesting part about this project is not only is it going to have the ads and have transcriptions of the ads, but it also allows you as a user to transcribe ads that they have digitized but haven't transcribed themselves. So there's a crowd sourcing kind of element to this project that I think is really exciting because it will allow that much more ads to be transcribed and allows people to participate in the project remotely. So you can have students transcribing ads and what have you, and then that builds the body of in the database. And they'll be adding bits and pieces to it over time, but the site just went live earlier this week, and it's really, I think, an exciting project, both for research and for teaching purposes. So I recommend people check it out.
Good.
All right, great. Until next week, Frank.
Have a good weekend, David. I'll speak to you soon.
Cheers.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at Whiskey Rebel Pod, and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.